Welcome to Learning English from the Voice of America. I'm Katie Weaver. On the show today, Alice Bryant brings you everyday grammar. And we close the show with the making of a nation. But first, Aigul said she was not really in the et mood, but that did not stop her from preparing a traditional Uyghur holiday meal Tuesday for family and friends at her home in Northern Virginia. In between serving bowls of lakman noodles and hot tea, Aigul and her guests talked about their families back home in China's far western region of Xinjiang. Some days it's even hard to breathe, she says, holding back tears. Even though it's Eid, we're always sad. Uyghurs in the United States came together this week to mark the Qurban Eid holiday, also known as Eid al-Adha. Yet, as several Uyghurs told VOA, it is hard to celebrate while knowing or not knowing what their family is going through back home. About 11 million Uyghurs live in Xinjiang. Over the last 2 years, China has effectively turned the region into a police state, with block-by-block security checkpoints, surveillance technology, and detention centers known as re-education camps. China says it is trying to prevent Islamic extremism and separatism among Uyghurs. Earlier this month, a United Nations official said she believes that China is holding as many as 1 million Uyghurs and other Muslims in these re-education camps. Another 2 million reportedly are attending open re-education camps daily and returning home at night. The whole Xinjiang Uyghur Autonomous Region, UN rights expert Gay McDougall said, resembles a massive internment camp. In answer, a Chinese official told the UN, the argument that 1 million are detained in re-education centers is completely untrue. Only those deceived by religious extremism, the official said, would be assisted by resettlement and re-education. China's efforts also have threatened many Uyghur cultural and religious traditions, including holding public gatherings and practicing Islam. Uyghurs living in the United States are eager to get together for holidays to pass on traditions to their children. Back in Xinjiang, Uyghurs usually go from house to celebrate Eid. They share a meal with family and stop by friends' homes to snack on Uyghur naan bread, dried fruit, and a special fried dough known as sangza. Here in the Washington area, Uyghurs continue that tradition at Aigul's home. Each of her guests has their own story of a loved one disappearing or of losing contact with their family. To protect their families in Xinjiang, all of the Uyghurs who spoke to VOA for this story chose not to use their real names. VOA was not able to independently confirm their stories. Nisa is a young Uyghur woman who came to the U.S. over 5 years ago for school. Earlier this year, she lost contact with her father. Her father, a government employee, was not political or very religious, Nisa told VOA. She later found out that while her father was in the hospital, authorities came to his room, put something over his head, and took him away. A family member explained to her over the phone, "They've taken your dad away to study." No one has been able to reach Nisa's father since he was taken. Ilham is a young Uyghur man in his 20s. He knows of at least 8 family members who are in re-education camps. But this week, he feels hopeful as he explains to others at Aygul's home that he believes he may have found a secure method to get news from family members back home. Talking to family in Xinjiang has become nearly impossible in recent months. The Chinese government closely examines everything that comes in and out of Xinjiang. Even simple interactions with people living overseas can put Uyghurs still in Xinjiang at risk. China's intimidation campaign is not limited to the region. Chinese authorities also pressure families in Xinjiang to get their family members overseas to provide detailed information about their daily lives. Gulbahar has lived in the Midwestern United States for the past year. She says Chinese government officials in March pressured her father to provide information about where she and her brothers go to school. They also wanted their home addresses and information about when they plan to return to China. Gulbahar passed along the requested information, fearing for her father's safety, she said. The father and daughter have not spoken since March. Gulbahar's phone calls and text messages have gone unanswered. On 8, she decided to send a simple holiday greeting to her parents over the Chinese messaging service WeChat. "I sent it this morning," Gulbahar said, "but I know I am not going to get anything back."
Oops, I spilled some coffee.
Let me think about it.
Woohoo! That's great news. Let's celebrate.
To the untrained ear, sounds like oops, and woohoo may seem like nonsense. But in English, these sounds carry a lot of meaning. We call them interjections, and the English language has hundreds of them. Interjections are informal sounds, words, or phrases that express the reactions or emotions of the speaker. There are interjections for nearly any feeling or response, such as excitement, happiness, surprise, or disappointment. Because there are so many English interjections, the best way to learn them is to hear how they're used. For example, if I accidentally spilled my coffee, my reaction would probably be one of regret. So, I might say, "Oops." Listen to how it is used.
"Oops, I spilled some coffee, but don't worry, I'll clean it up."
We use oops to show regret for having done or said something wrong. It's like saying, "I made a mistake." Native English speakers use interjections every day, and that includes everyone from babies to older adults. In fact, a baby's first word might be an interjection. A baby might say, "ow" or "ouch" when they touch something too hot, or "yum" when their food tastes delicious. But an adult might, too. Interjections are used in spoken English, in formal writing, and creative writing, including in books, films, and songs. You may remember American singer Britney Spears' most famous song, "Oops, I Did It Again," in which she shows regret for breaking someone's heart. We do not use interjections in formal writing, such as essays or research papers. And we usually avoid them in professional messages, such as business letters or emails. Yet, their informal status does not make them any less useful of a communication tool. Even respected dictionaries now include their meanings. There are two types of interjections, primary and secondary. Primary interjections are individual words and sounds that are used only as interjections. They have no other meanings or uses, such as the words from earlier in our program, oops, hmm, woo-hoo, ow, ouch, and yum. Secondary interjections are words or phrases that already belong to other parts of speech, such as boy, awesome, and oh my God. These words all have separate meanings as interjections. For example, the original meaning of the word boy is male child. But as an interjection, its meaning is completely different. It is used to express a strong reaction, such as interest or surprise. Here's an example.
My cat destroyed my roommate's favorite plant. Boy, was he mad. But I promised to replace it by Sunday.
Using the interjection boy brings attention to the extent of the roommate's anger. Even though interjections are informal, they are parts of speech. They can be nouns, verbs, or adverbs. Here is an interjection as a noun.
Baloney! That's the stupidest thing I've ever heard.
Using the word baloney is a direct and somewhat confrontational way of saying, I don't agree with that. As a verb,
get out! The tickets sold out in 15 minutes? That's impossible.
Get out means I don't believe it and is usually used in a friendly way. And as an adverb,
I can't make it today. I have a meeting at 5 p.m.
Simply means no, but is usually used to emphasize a negative answer to a question, request, or offer. But be careful not to mistake with an interjection that sounds and looks similar, but has the opposite meaning. It means yes. It can also be used to show that you agree or understand. Here's an example.
Do you know what I mean?
I feel the same way.
Interjections do not follow usual English rules of punctuation. They mostly have no relationship to other parts of a sentence. So, they are usually written separately and followed by an exclamation point or a period. This is because their meanings alone can often express a complete thought. Earlier in the program, for example, we told you that oops means I made a mistake. That is a complete thought, so it does not need to be part of a sentence. Still, we can follow some interjections with a comma. You could, for example, write, "Oops, I spilled some coffee," with a comma following "oops" instead of a period or exclamation point. The punctuation usually depends on the emotion you are expressing. To show excitement, we usually use an exclamation point after an interjection, which keeps it separate from sentences. Okay, now let's learn a few more common interjections. If something is generally unpleasant, whether in appearance, taste, or smell, you can say yuck, ew, ick, or blech. If you want to say something tastes or smells good, you can use mmm or yum. If you are frustrated or upset about something, you might say ugh or arg. I'm Alice Bryant.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation. I'm Steve Ember. The months before Election Day in November of 1980 were difficult for President Jimmy Carter. Many Americans blamed the Democrat for the nation's economic problems, including high inflation and high unemployment. Many also blamed him for not gaining the release of 52 American hostages in Iran. About a year earlier, Muslim extremists had seized the United States Embassy in Tehran and taken the Americans as prisoners. President Carter urged all Americans to support his administration during the crisis. As the months went by, however, he made no progress in bringing the hostages home. The Iranians rejected negotiations for their release, and an attempt to rescue them failed. The president appeared powerless. Carter's political weakness led another Democrat, Ted Kennedy, to compete against him for the party's nomination. The Republican Party, however, was united behind a strong candidate, Ronald Reagan, a former actor and former governor of California. Reagan's running mate for vice president was George H.W. Bush. Bush had served in Congress and as head of the Central Intelligence Agency. He had also represented the United States as ambassador to China and to the United Nations. The inability of the Carter administration to solve the hostage crisis and other problems made many Americans feel that their country was weak. Reagan promised to give them confidence once more in the nation's strength. Carter and Reagan debated each other several weeks before the election. To some people, Carter seemed angry and defensive, while Reagan seemed calm and thoughtful.
Next Tuesday is Election Day. Next Tuesday, all of you will go to the polls and make a decision. I think when you make that decision, it might be well if you would ask yourself, are you better off than you were 4 years ago? Is it easier for you to go and buy things in the stores than it was 4 years ago? Is there more or less unemployment in the country than there was 4 years ago? Is America as respected throughout the world as it was? And if you answer all of those questions yes, why then I think your choice is very obvious as to who you will vote for. If you don't agree, if you don't think that this course that we've been on for the last 4 years is what you would like to see us follow for the next four, then I could suggest another choice that you have.
On Election Day, voters gave Reagan a huge victory. It became known as the Reagan Revolution. Inauguration Day was January 20th, 1981. Ronald Reagan became the nation's 40th president and, at 69, the oldest ever elected. In his inaugural speech, the new president talked about the goals of his administration. A major goal was to reduce the size of the federal government. Reagan and other conservatives believed that the nation's economy was suffering because of high taxes and unnecessary laws. Government, he said, was not the solution to the problem. Government was the problem. Ronald Reagan was born in 1911 in the small community of Tampico, Illinois. He was a good student and a good athlete. While in college, he became interested in acting. But he did not have enough money to go to New York or Hollywood to study to become an actor. Instead, he tried out for a job as a sports announcer on radio. A radio station in Davenport, Iowa, liked his creativity and gave him the job. Later, Dutch Reagan, as he was called, worked at a radio station in Des Moines, Iowa, and then he moved to the big city, Chicago, where he worked as an announcer for the Chicago Cubs baseball team. In March of 1937, the Cubs were in California for spring training. Reagan went along, and while he was there, he took a screen test with Warner Brothers. The movie studio liked the friendly, handsome young man and offered him a job. Before long, Ronald Reagan was a Hollywood star. In the 1940 film Canute Rockne, All-American, Reagan played Notre Dame University college football player George Gipp. His deathbed speech contained a line that would often be associated with the Reagan presidency.
Ask them to go in there with all they've got. Win just one for the Gipper. I don't know where I'll be then, but I'll know about it. I'll be happy.
In King's Row, Reagan played a double amputee who had lost both legs.
Randy! Randy! Where's the rest of me?
Drake.
Randy!
Yes, Drake?
It was that accident.
Yes, dear. But don't talk about it yet.
He remembered King's Row as the film that made him a star. During World War II, Reagan joined what was then the Army Air Corps and made training films. Reagan became deeply interested in politics during his years in Hollywood. He started out a liberal, but his political views became increasingly conservative. He served six times as president of the Screen Actors Guild, a union of movie actors. After the war, Reagan guided the Screen Actors Guild through a frightening time for actors and others in the entertainment industry. It was the time of the powerful House Un-American Activities Committee. Its hearings resulted in the feared blacklist. The blacklist was responsible for hurting, even ending, the careers of many in the film and television industries if they were thought to be communists or to have communist sympathies. It was through the blacklist scare that Reagan met his second wife, Nancy Davis. Her name had mistakenly been confused with that of another actress, causing it to appear on a blacklist, and she sought Reagan's help in correcting the mistake. They fell in love and would marry in 1952.
Must be a big push this time, Case.
The Admiral told me not to tell.
Reagan and Nancy Davis appeared together in the World War II drama Hellcats of the Navy, in which he played a naval officer and she a Navy nurse who loved him.
The Admiral should have told me not to worry.
I thought we'd settled all that about you and me.
It won't stay settled, Case. Not until you tell me you stopped caring.
By the early 1950s, Reagan stopped appearing in movies and turned instead to a new medium, television.
And every Sunday night, General Electric brings you the finest motion picture stars on TV.
For many years, Ronald Reagan was the commercial spokesman for General Electric and host of a series of dramatic shows. For much of his life, Ronald Reagan was a Democrat. But by 1960, he was making speeches for conservative Republican candidates. In 1966, he became a candidate himself. He ran as a Republican for governor of California. Democrats did not take him seriously. They made fun of some of his movie roles, as in Bedtime for Bonzo, a comedy where his co-star was a chimp. But Reagan had the last laugh. He won the election by almost a million votes. As governor, Reagan was praised for reducing the state's debt, but criticized for raising taxes. Some people also thought he reacted too strongly against student unrest on college campuses. But he won re-election in 1970. In 1976, Reagan ran for the Republican presidential nomination. He came close to winning that nomination away from President Gerald Ford. After accepting the nomination, Ford asked Reagan to share the stage with him. The strong welcome that Reagan received was a clear sign of his future in the party. That future would come just 4 years later when Reagan won the presidency. On Reagan's inauguration day, Iran finally released the hostages it had been holding for 444 days. Walter Cronkite paused in his CBS television coverage of the inauguration for this breaking news report from Dan Rather.
Walter, according to our CBS News sources at Tehran Airport, one of the two Algerian jetliners is taxiing, or was just a few moments ago. Now, as best we can make it out, here is where the situation with the American hostages stands at this moment. They remain in Tehran, or at least they were up until just a few moments ago, at the airport, apparently moments away from their flight to freedom, a few moments after spending 444 days in captivity. And can you imagine what it must have been like inside that airliner for the hostages this morning?
As president, Ronald Reagan quickly began work to get Congress to reduce taxes. He also began a weekly series of radio broadcasts. Each Saturday, he would comment on developments in American life and politics. Reagan's ability to relate to people earned him the nickname the Great Communicator. 2 months after he took office, Ronald Reagan was shot while leaving an event at a hotel in Washington. In the first moments, no one realized that he had been hit, but there was a bullet in his left lung, close to his heart. At the hospital, Reagan jokingly told the doctors, "I hope you're all Republicans." They were able to remove the bullet, and he made a full recovery. The gunman, 25-year-old John Hinckley Jr., was sent to a mental hospital. His explanation for the attack was that he was trying to impress the actress Jodie Foster.
That's all the time we have for the show today. For VOA Learning English, I'm Katie Weaver.